I'm getting ready to do. I'd like to call the Hess Committee meeting together, and the time is 1:40. At this time, we have four members present. We have Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, Senator Dyson, and myself, Betty Davis. We are first going to take a resolution up before we go into the presentation that's going to be done. I'll turn the floor over to you, Senator McGuire.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the Senate Hess Committee. Thank you for taking the time today to hear this resolution. All of you in the room have heard it before. I've introduced it every year since I've been a member over in the other body and then now. And the reason that brain injury became so important to me is that my only sibling, my younger brother, was in a car accident when he was 17 years old on the Seward Highway, and he suffered a traumatic brain injury, a brain stem shearing. And at that time, Madam Chairman, back in 1992, Alaska was very ill prepared to respond to our family. There weren't the kind of networks out there to pass on information. And so I got to walk in the shoes that many Alaskan families have walked in and will be walking in. So the issue touches me personally, which isn't unlike a lot of the things we do here. I think in the Senate, we do the best when they have touched our lives personally and can speak to them. And the Brain Injury Network will give their presentation about what it is that they do to try and address brain injury awareness. And theirs is a day in, day out, not just a resolution, not just a moment in time. But the point of the resolution is to make March of 2008 in Alaska Brain Injury Awareness Month. And it is brain injury is the leading cause of death and disability among children and young adults in our state. And I don't know how many Alaskans know that is the number one cause of death and disability. There's an estimated 12,000 people in the state that have suffered from traumatic brain injury, and most of them, Madam Chairman and members, suffer in silence. You know, we call it a silent epidemic. It's the kind of thing that you don't end up with folks that have survived brain injury walking among us in daily life that often. We don't talk about it. When they do, families and victims tend to suffer in silence. And so there are 12,000 of these people in our state and their families that are living through this, and we want to raise awareness of brain injury and to draw attention to prevention, treatment, and the support that we have. And you can read through the rest of the resolution. I won't walk through every detail with the committee, but I think suffice it to say that Alaska is touched in a way that is particularly unique. And it is the kind of injury that's preventable, and that's what makes it so difficult. And I know, Madam Chair, you've worked a lot on colon cancer and cervical cancer issues, and there's a similar kind of feeling that you have with that they are preventable and treatable. And so if we can raise awareness, if we can bring the resources to the state and draw attention during the month of March and other days, we're helping Alaskan families. And so I think the last thing that I want to say is that we know that passing a resolution isn't going to solve problems in an immediate way. We know that just the passage of this resolution won't fix it. But I think what I've come to learn in my time in the legislature is that having a resolution and the testimony that goes with it can highlight a really important problem in the state. And so my goal, again, as it has been the last 7 years, is to bring forward a resolution that we all sign off on. The Brain Injury Network will highlight, and hopefully we will raise awareness to a level that at least maybe one family that goes through a traumatic brain injury we'll know a little bit more about. And with that, I would take any questions.
All right, thank you very much. Yes, Senator Dyson, you have a question or
yeah,
a statement?
Thank you. When we've had this discussion in the past, and I appreciate you bringing it forward, I've asked that you all consider making it Brain Injury Month, not Traumatic Brain Injury, in light of the fact that we lead the nation on non-traumatic brain injury, particularly prenatal alcohol poisoning of children. And once again, I think that hasn't happened. And I guess I want to know if you guys actually considered including the non-traumatic brain injury in the focus of this month or not.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, you know, I am willing to, between now and the next committee or the floor, to go back and add more of those statistics in. They are difficult to put your fingers around. They're not as easy as the traumatic brain injury statistics. But if you notice in the title, we say Brain Injury Awareness Month. So we got that part. But you're right, it would be, I think, helpful to have more statistics in there regarding non-traumatic brain injury. And the Brain Injury Network, when they come up, can describe a little bit of their evolution, because they started out with more of the focus on trauma.
Yep.
Certainly, you know, it's the motorcycle accidents and the vehicular, but they also focus on the non-traumatic as well. And so that's certainly something that I'd like to go back and continue to focus on. Trevor, do you have anything you want to add? No, Jill does.
For the record, I'm Jill Hodges. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Brain Injury Network. And through the chair, Senator Dyson, I wanted to add that it's very important to highlight traumatic brain injury for a few reasons. And one of those is the state has begun to develop capacity for other sorts of brain injuries, for FASD, for stroke, for those. But at this moment, there's limited awareness and services for traumatic brain injury. And so that's why we try to keep that in the highlight, knowing that if we beef up the system for traumatic brain injury, that the other acquired brain injuries are also going to benefit from those additions to the state-funded brain injury programs.
Yes, make a
so what I infer from what you've said is non-traumatic brain injury is hugely important, but at this point you would prefer not to dilute your effort here away from the traumatic brain injury, where there's more need for more action.
And I would say yes. The mission of this organization is for the survivors of traumatic brain injury and their family members.
Okay.
And so we have to keep that first and foremost.
All right. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions from committee members? Thank you. We have before us a resolution that is quite important, and it's SCR 170. And I'd like to move this out of our committee if possible. I think everyone is in agreement that this is a great day to do this. And it's a worthwhile procedure. The sooner we get it to the floor, the better. And I do think this will bring awareness to a lot of people, that because I've gotten emails or calls from people that talk about that, and they must pick it up from some of the information that's been given because they call at this time. So if you don't have another question or any statements to make, I'd like for somebody to make, you have a statement?
Just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess I share the same concerns as does my good friend from Eagle River, and I would encourage people to continue to look at that as this moves forward. I don't want to hold it up based on that, but you know, there is a fair amount of information regarding traumatic brain injury, and there is a fair amount of information regarding the other situations, but I think we should emphasize those as well, because a lot of damage is done in the other area, and I believe that they are important. And you already have, as the good senator indicated, it's already brain It is, the title is Brain Injury Awareness Month, and I realize that some may not consider the word injury as appropriate, maybe even for what happens in the other circumstances that were mentioned, but still, I think it is important to emphasize that it's a terrible situation. Some of the others that are not, you know, emphasized here, and the statistics may be difficult to gather, but I think we probably could, and I would encourage people to continue to look at that as it moves forward. And with that, I would make a motion.
And before you make the motion, okay, we also have somebody to testify.
Oh, okay.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Is there anybody in the audience that plan to testify? We do have somebody online, Richard and Mary Warrington. Are you there?
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Senate Pest Committee. My name is Richard Warrington. I was appointed ambassador from the Brain Injury Association of America. I'm a survivor of traumatic brain injury that happened going on 30 years ago in Colorado. I've been in Alaska 22 years, and I'm still disabled from the injury, from cognitive problems. And then about the TBI Awareness Month bill, I encourage you, because there's one in Congress to pass being a national Brain Injury Awareness Month, and even the military base in San Antonio has got announcements about March being TBI Awareness Month for all the military veterans coming back from the war with brain injury. Because TBI is the number one killing disabler above cancer. Do any of you have any questions?
Any questions from the committee?
No.
No questions at this time. Is Mary there?
Mary is here. Thank you. I just would like
to... You want to state your name for the record, please?
Mary Warrington.
Yes.
I am a member of the Alaska Brain Injury Network Board, and my two brothers had a brain injury. I grew up with them, and it is a lifelong injury. It is the silent epidemic, and it really needs to be made aware of. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
We thank you for your testimony. If there's no one else, now I can entertain a motion for the bill.
I make a motion that, Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 17 be moved from this committee to the next committee of referral, or is there any? There is, obviously. And there is no fiscal note, correct?
Right.
With individual recommendations.
I hear no objections to that, so... It has passed from Hess. It goes from here to Ruse. Do we have present Representative Ledoux or her staff? Oh, you're there. Okay. You're just in time.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gabrielle Ledoux from House District 36, and I'm here to introduce HB 252, the Richard Foster, Stanley M. Robbins, and Alex Caesar Donor Act, an act requiring paid leave from employment for organ and bone marrow donation. And the gist of this bill is that it only applies to state workers. The employer is not required to provide more than 80 hours of leave. However, the leave may not be less than 40 hours unless the employee requests fewer hours. According to the Life Alaska Donor Services, there are an average 160 patients waiting for a kidney transplant in Alaska. There are fewer than 20 kidney transplant recipients in Alaska each year. Fewer than 100 people in Alaska are awaiting a bone marrow transplant. There are about 30 states who have laws similar to HB 252. 23 of those apply only to state employees. And also, there is a bill in Congress right now that would make living organ or bone marrow donation a part of the Family Medical Leave Act. The bill, however, before the committee today does not apply to the general workforce, as does the Family Medical Leave Act does. It only applies to State of Alaska employees. And I have with me my aide, Sonia Heimer, who can guide you into the specifics of the bill.
Yes.
Would you like me to go through the sectional?
Yes, I need you to state your name for the record, and then you may go through it.
For the record, my name is Sonia Heimer with the Office of Representative Gabrielle Ledoux. So section one of the bill, I'll just go step by step through the sectional analysis. There's the short title of this bill is the Richard Foster, Stanley M. Robbins, and Alex Caesar Donor Act. Richard Foster, as you all know, is the representative from Nome who is seeking a kidney transplant. He's been in the news quite a bit lately because there's a member of the staff here in this building who is a match for kidney donation, who until recently would have been prohibited by the ethics rules, I gather, from donating. This bill would allow the prospective donor to take paid leave from work to undergo the testing and the surgery to donate a kidney. The other person in the short title, Stanley M. Robbins, is the late husband of Representative Cisna. He was also staff for many years to Representative Grunberg. And then Alex Caesar is the little boy who received a bone marrow donation, I guess last year, from a man in New Mexico. The section two and section three of this bill merely are merely conforming amendments to renumbering because of a previous repeal in statute. Section four is the substantive section of the bill. It provides a new section to Alaska statutes that would allow paid administrative leave for state employees of, as Representative Ledoux mentioned, not more than 80 hours and not less than 40 hours, unless the employee requests fewer hours. And this paid administrative leave could also include time spent on a screening process to determine suitability as a donor. This bill would apply only to State of Alaska employees. And that's basically the gist of the bill.
All right, thank you very much. I think Senator Calgary, are you there? Senator Calgary?
Yeah, this is Senator Calgary. I've been trying to get on since 1:25, so I'm sorry.
Sorry about that. Glad to have you.
Thank you. I'm here. Ready.
All right, thank you. Was there any questions or comment? Senator Thomas has a question or a statement.
Just a question. Thank you, Madam Chairman. In the sponsor statement, it says bone marrow donations may be, it says that there doesn't really have a number for that. You do for kidney transplants and the increase there and kidney dialysis, how many people are on that. Do you have a guesstimation of how many bone marrow transplants? Probably are a lot done in the state of Alaska. Is that the reason why they're done outside, obviously, because of the expertise?
I'm sorry, that you, through the chair, the question was
Number of bone marrow transplants that are done on an annual basis in the state of Alaska, like the other statistics you have, or mm-hmm. annual?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I know that there are approximately five people per year in Alaska donating bone marrow. Whether those procedures are actually performed in the state mm-hmm. or not, I don't know. I also wanted to mention that on the telephone, we have two experts. We have from Life Alaska, Life Alaska donors, we have Bruce Selnerides, and we also have somebody from the Department of Labor.
Maybe they could speak more specifically to that. But my question was that, you know, why we did not consider the bill being broader to encourage other employers to allow their employees to participate in the same, particularly in the bone marrow, if it's that small a number of folks that we're concerned with, so.
I suppose because I decided that politics is the art of the possible, mm-hmm. and that it seemed like this bill might stand a better chance of passing if it was limited to state employees, that there would be less of a chance that lobbyists from various commercial interests would be lobbying against the bill if it was just involved state employees.
If I may.
You may continue.
And that concern that you have is probably rightly placed, and that's why I wanted to get that on the record, I guess, that there is concern by some that leads to possibly the inability for people to receive potentially life-saving treatment based on an employer not allowing someone to take that time off. Now, I guess if somebody was dedicated enough, they would probably do it, but it is a financial burden as well as a medical burden to somebody for all of these procedures that we're talking about. So I don't expect you to explain, you know, potentially who opposed it or not, but it just seems that that could have been addressed in some fashion, numbers of employees or whatever, so it wasn't a terrible burden to the employer, although I guess the financial end of it will always be considered a burden.
Well, I'm not going to say that I know for sure that there would have been great opposition or anything, but when we were formulating the bill, we just decided that you do things sometimes step by step.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Senator Cowdery.
Yes?
I was wondering, I see it designates March 2008 as the Brain Injury Awareness Month. I was wondering what types of activities cause the brain injury, traumatic brain injury, what types of programs and activities take place in the month of March, or is it related? Why the month of March, in other words?
Somebody want to speak to the, we're not on that particular bill, but we could get that answer for you. I'm sorry, we completed that bill before you came on.
Well, okay, I'm sorry to even bring it up.
Okay. Are you done with your presentation?
Yes. Oh, I'm through.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for anyone else? Is there anybody in the audience that want to speak to this bill? I have no one that wants to testify. There are two people online that will answer questions if need to be. Did you think we need to call an expert up for the questions that you had to ask Senator Thomas?
No, we don't need anybody to testify to that unless, but I would like to know the bone marrow aspect of it. I find the other statistics interesting, so I'd like to know that one too as well. But they don't have to testify to it now. If somebody just sent me an email or something, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, thank you. All right, thank you very much.
This is Senator Cowdery.
Yes, Senator.
Does any of the other states have similar provisions for this employee leave?
There are 30 states who have laws similar to this law, to this statute.
Do they just include state employees, or do they include?
23 of those apply only to state employees.
I see. Thank you.
You're welcome. What's the pleasure or wishes of this committee about this particular bill?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Elton.
Madam Chair, I think we're shooting a little bit low here, and I'm disappointed that this is that we have limited it only to state employees, but it does have another committee of referral. So, if you're prepared, I'd make a motion to move the bill with the attached fiscal notes.
And that was zero, wasn't it?
I think there are a couple of zero fiscal notes, Madam Chair. Yep.
Anybody opposed to that? There would be no need for a roll call. The bill will go to the next committee of referral.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We're glad to have a presentation on brain injury, and we're going to call that group up now.
Thank you, Senator Davis. And for the record, again, I'm Jill Hodges with the Brain Injury Network. And through the chair, is it okay that I answer Senator Cowdery's question?
Yes, you may.
Okay, great. And Senator Cowdery, your question was why choose March as Brain Injury Awareness Month. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, at the national level, the federal government names March Brain Injury Awareness Month. So we're trying to keep Alaska consistent with what is happening nationally. And a few activities that the Brain Injury Network has planned is we take part in the Mental Health Trust Authority You Know Me campaign. And so through the month of March, we really beef up our advertising and work through the newspapers and radio PSAs to get the word out. And also in the month of April, we do outreach. And so it's an awareness that we'll be headed to Tok and Barrow this upcoming year. And in addition, the military has planned public forums from February to May, and they have asked that the public forum in Anchorage for the month of March be focused on traumatic brain injury. So those will be a few programs.
I see.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you for having us back. And yesterday, we presented to the House HESS Committee, and we presented to a panel of females. So it's very nice to have a mix of males and females in the room. And today should be a very interactive day, so please ask lots of questions. And with me today, we have Captain Barker. Captain Barker is a psychologist on Elmendorf. And he'll really speak to what is happening in the military here in Alaska in regards to traumatic brain injury, and what sort of impact does he see over the next few months on base and off base as well. We also have Mrs. Stephanie Tanner. And Stephanie Tanner is the wife of Sergeant Tanner, who is a military active duty who has suffered a traumatic brain injury back in 2004. And we also have Dr. Russell Cherry, who's a neuropsychologist at Providence. And I think the information that Dr. Cherry has to offer is very pertinent on an entire Alaska scale. He's worked in the VA system before. He's previously worked at the Native Hospital. He does inpatient and outpatient care at Providence. And he does assessments for the mental health and the wellness courts. And to show that traumatic brain injury really does touch more than just the individual. It touches the community and it touches the state as well. And the overall message, I think, that we're trying to relay really has to do with the fact that TBI specific programming is standard in lots of other states, and that it really is the partnership and the coordination between state-funded programs, case management specifically, the role that the providers have in developing more traumatic brain injury infrastructure, rehab, and having the right people in place for the step-down programs. You have the hospital setting, and then you have the step-down rehab, and then the community setting as well. So it's really important, and the providers here in Alaska want to beef up their TBI infrastructure, but we also have the recognition that it's more than just their role. To have funding related to that individual, and to have case management related to making sure that person is accessing the programs needed for the best outcome for a traumatic brain injury survivor. And also the role of the military. And the military, I mean, they should really be applauded over the last few months on what they've been able to develop here in the state. The state of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has been tracking brain injury data for 10 years, And anecdotal information is now turned into hard numbers that Alaska really has a public health issue in regards to TBI, and it really is an epidemic. And the military had months, they were given months notice that 3,200 soldiers would return in December, and potentially, on the, if you compare the national average, 20% of them may screen positive for traumatic brain injury and have symptoms related to traumatic brain injury. And Captain Barr could really speak to what they have been able to develop with in-state and out-of-state personnel and what they hope the outcome will be for their soldiers. And then also the role of the individual. And it really is the individual's responsibility to understand what is traumatic brain injury. And it wasn't until my younger brother had a brain injury 2 years ago that I even paid attention to traumatic brain injury. But honestly, there are thousands of Alaskans right now who are driving on these roads and walking on these very slippery sidewalks. They're participating in recreational and industry activities that are just high risk, because that's the nature of Alaskans, and that TBI happens. And right now, today, there will be two Alaskans that have a severe traumatic brain injury. They're medevaced from their village or and/or admitted into a hospital, and their family is going to be changed, and that survivor is going to be changed, and that 20% of those folks don't make it as well. So this is a disability that should be recognized. And what really is an important point to point out, the military, is that the military chose to recognize TBI. They chose to commit to TBI and commit to developing services for TBI, and funding came with that. And it wasn't until that recognition happened and the importance happened that the funding came and the services are now there for Alaskans with TBI. And so in that, I would like to have Captain Barker and Stephanie Tanner join, and they'll present, and I believe Captain Barker has a PowerPoint. So they look formal, but they're really nice people. And so please ask questions throughout the presentations. Does anybody have any questions for me before I?
Yes, Senator Elton.
And this may be answered in the presentation. I mean, I'm assuming, and you can tell me whether my assumption is correct, is traumatic brain injury, is that always due to a physical event, or can non-physical events like drug use or other things?
I'm going to let Dr. Cherry really speak to that. But what I will speak to is that there are acquired brain injuries and there are traumatic brain injuries. Here in the state of Alaska, the definition of a traumatic brain injury is a blow to the head. And what that, but that falls under an acquired brain injury. So a traumatic brain injury is a type of acquired brain injury. And he'll really be able to speak to that better.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Hey, will you state your name for the records, please?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, my name is Captain Richard Barker. I'm a clinical psychologist from Elmendorf Air Force Base. I'm really here to talk about the military aspect from TBI. IEDs is kind of common knowledge now what IEDs are, but up here you see two pictures of different type of IEDs. The top one being just the IED that is put on the side of the road, under the ground, looks like a piece of trash, and is very specific on pretty much what it hits. With the other picture being a vehicle-borne IED, which usually has quite a bit more explosives that pretty much does a lot more devastation and is going to impact a lot more individuals. Mild traumatic brain injury or post-concussive syndrome has really become the signature injury of the war. It's going to imply, if you think about post-concussive syndrome, it implies a milder head injury. Here in Alaska, we don't have the capability at Elmendorf or Fort Rich to be able to handle severe, moderate to severe head injury. I mean, they're going to stay in the lower 48 to get the treatment that they need. The milder cases, we will see, and we have begun seeing. Most of those individuals get better within 3 to 6 months, 12 months, but there are a few individuals that will continue on past 12 months and continue to have lifelong problems, even with just having a mild traumatic brain injury. The DVBIC, I don't know if you're aware of what the DVBIC is, but the DVBIC is a Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center. They've been kind of working brain injuries since the early 1990s. Their definition of TBI is it's an injury to the brain resulting from a blast, a fall, direct impact, or motor vehicle accident, which causes an alteration in mental status, resulting in a plethora of both physical and cognitive problems, concentration problems, drowsiness, lethargy, and things like that. Lots of different types of brain injuries. I'm not going to go into them all, but from the combat that's we're seeing, the injuries that we're getting has a lot more implications than the sports injuries, and that's kind of what we've been using in the past for models of treatment and getting research done and things like that. The combat MTBI is really from the blast. There's a lot of variables, but the brain is being twisted and turned and banged around a lot more, which is really either cutting axons, stretching them, or just really twisting them up, and so it's causing a lot of significant problems that are ongoing with our members. Some quick facts: approximately 1.4 million TBIs occur in the U.S. every year, and that's probably underreported. As the senator said earlier, it is kind of a silent illness, a silent disease, because of lack of knowledge. Getting hurt, hitting your head, maybe feeling a little dazed and confused, no reason to go to the emergency room, but yet that could be a mild traumatic brain injury and could cause continued problems. 22% of OIF vets reported experiencing an MTBI event. 7% reported continuation of symptoms, whether that be immediately after the incident or ongoing once they return back to the States. A study that was done at a major theater hospital that screened about 7,500 showed that 23% were positive for TBI, while 75% complained of symptoms. So whether that be headaches or dizziness or problems with noise, drowsiness, those type of things. But as you can see, it is a major public concern in general. And although head injuries have always been around, I think the war has maybe brought this more to the forefront for a lot of public knowledge and public awareness. The military attempts to catch TBI, really when they come back through our PDHA, which is our post-deployment health assessment. It's kind of a standardized form, but that is when they come back. So we are continuously trying to work at identifying them earlier, because earlier intervention is going to help with treatment overall. A couple more facts. A lot of times neuroimaging studies come up negative. So a lot of times you have individuals complaining of TBI type symptoms, but then there's no lab work or there's no neuroimaging that comes back saying there's anything wrong. So they are kind of put off saying, things will get better and don't compare it to the TBI. But I think with higher or more educated providers, the more awareness, I think that is hopefully going to be going away, and we're going to be a little bit more sensitive to ruling out TBI before letting the patient leave. The big thing is with ruptured eardrums, there's going to be a three-time likelihood of having a TBI. So some things that we are doing in the DOD. We are starting to use the ANAM, the Automated Neuropsychological Assessment Metric. What that is it's really a brief cognitive screener prior to deployment, which gives us kind of a baseline. So when the individual comes back and we suspect an injury or we expect suspect an exposure, we can retest them and then look at their baseline and see, you know, is there any differences, and then that can hopefully lead to further intervention if needed. But as you can see, right after the injury, you can see the problems that are reported and how the problems just continue to increase and worsen as they get home. And a lot of that is because, you know, they haven't been treated. They've had multiple injuries and a lot of other variables. Really, this slide is just to show that with 50 participants at a DIVBIC facility study, there's a lot of comorbid issues that go along with TBI, which makes it difficult to rule out. Is it TBI? Is it major depression disorder? Is it post-traumatic stress disorder? Is it a cognitive disorder? Is it related to substance abuse? I mean, a lot of issues that have to be ruled out. Treatment I'm not going to hit so much on, so I spend a little bit more time letting you know what we are doing at Elmendorf and Fort Richardson to help with the returnees. But I do want to hit on the real three key elements to recovery. Education and reassurance. Education is huge. Educating before the individual goes to a deployment, during their treatment time, as well as with ongoing recovery. Education needs to happen not only to the service member, but to the family members and to providers and to the community, because it is a public concern. And you know, just because military is coming back, you know, we go out and interact with the community every day. And the more awareness that's out there is going to be helpful for everybody.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may make a statement and ask a question, I happen to represent Eagle River and Elmendorf are in my district.
Yes, sir.
And that district has the largest number of active and retired military any place in the state, which we're delighted with. And I appreciate this, and if there's anything I can do to help you get the message out in the community groups, newspapers, whatever, that's valuable, you know, I'd really like to be whatever help I can. And Representative Dahlstrom and Fairclough, who also represent the area, I'm sure would be delighted to. So anything we can do to help that particular portion, and then if the patients, clients that you are seeing and so on are indeed using community services, and is anything we can do to increase those services or make them better or whatever, I'd be glad to hear and help.
And sir, Dr. Cherry is going to be speaking specifically to that as a provider in the community.
All right, so I'll leave you my card, and I've got to run off to another responsibility. And, yes, and to both of you, thank you for what you're doing.
Okay.
And we Thanks. Really appreciate the service that you do, but the service the men you're serving do, or the men and women.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You may continue.
The education, as I said, is important. The reassurance goes along with reassuring the active duty member as well as the family members that they are going to get better. If we don't set them up with the expectation that they're going to get better, they're going to kind of be distraught, and they're going to it's going to impact their recovery for sure. Barriers to recovery is really 60 days post injury with ongoing high stress duty. If you think about being in the military, especially with the Army, especially with that masculine hoorah attitude, most of those individuals don't want to step off the line, step away from their buddies, get out from the combat to take care of themselves. They want to be there with their friends. They want to be able to help protect and be there. So they're being put back out multiple times. They don't go and report that they've had, you know, a close call, that they've been dazed and confused, that they've been throwing up or having problems sleep. So they're getting put right back out. So they're experiencing multiple IED blasts or just head injury type of events, which is going to affect the outcome, because really rest and recovery is the primary thing that can happen right at the beginning to help with outcome. And then comorbid conditions, as I said kind of earlier, PTSD, major depression, pain disorders, because a lot of times when we're exposed to blasts, we also have a lot of other pain issues. And then substance abuse is pretty huge. Treatment issues, again, don't want to really spend much time on that. But just to go over TBI versus PTSD, there is a lot of overlap. Kind of the biggest way to differentiate between TBI and PTSD is the symptoms that occur right after the event are usually TBI related, meaning headaches, ringing of the ears, maybe some sleep problems, impulsivity issues, which can also be PTSD related, those last two. But PTSD will usually come months later, a lot of times when they start to slow down and get back into a safe environment and that. So I'll leave that slide up and want to update you on what we're doing at Elmendorf and Fort Richardson. I've been there since September of 06. In about June or July of this last year, we started preparing for the Army soldiers coming back. We started preparing by beginning to educate our providers, ourselves, the community as much as possible on TBI-related issues. We have begun to set up a TBI, mild TBI clinic. Again, we are focusing on the mild to moderate. The severe probably will not make it up here, although severe might come up later on after they've recovered as much as they can in the lower 48, because a lot of veterans do come up and retire in the Alaska area. But so how we did that is we got together with the Army and the Air Force to get extra providers sent to us. And we are right now working at the Elmendorf Med Group Hospital. Under one roof, we have both Air Force and Army, as well as civilians that are focused on just the TBI component. Most of the soldiers are back, or I should say all the soldiers from 425 are back, and they have returned from block leave the 25th or so of January. So since that time, we've seen, well, prior to that time, we've seen 100 individuals come through just our neurology clinic. So that does not count for the people that are being seen by their PCMs to deal with headaches or deal with ringing of the ears or sight problems or whatever else that could also be caused from the TBI. So there's probably a lot more. We're expecting maybe a wave to come in once they kind of get over their honeymoon phase of, I'm back in my work, I'm back with my family, but now problems are starting to come up. I'm forgetting things, I'm getting in trouble by my wife, I'm getting in trouble by command, I just can't keep things going, and so now I need to start looking at what's going on, and maybe the docs are telling me that I could be having a traumatic brain injury, and maybe there's something that I need to look into further. So we have about 50 individuals that have come in, but this is only a short-term fix for us right now. We are trying to establish a clinic that's going to be by itself, self-sustaining MTBI clinic. But right now, that's not happening just because of logistics and the amount of time it takes. But we have a short-term fix with extra neurologists, extra neuropsych people coming in, extra mental health, occupational therapists, speech therapists, audiologists, those to help us out. So that's where we're at Fort Rich and Elmendorf Air Force Base.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Elton.
Madam Chair, thanks, Captain. And I'm looking up here, and I'm still struggling with the issue a little bit, because I'm assuming that as you make a diagnosis, that the diagnosis isn't made based on what you see in an MRI or some other kind of a physical check, but a lot of it is symptomatic. Is that correct?
Diagnosis, are you saying specifically to TBI, sir?
Yes, especially, I guess, probably especially moderate TBI.
Yeah, what we want to do is we want to try to get the whole person concept. So we're trying to get an entire history of, you know, what's happened with what was the factors that were involved, how many times had they been exposed to IED blasts or falls or vehicle accidents, as well as growing up, you know, playing football, how many times did you have a concussion? Going through airborne training, how many times did you have a fall and hit the ground pretty hard and have those issues? So we're trying to get the full spectrum, and then also look into PTSD stuff, which might be related to the combat, the depression stuff, you know, psychosocial stressors that are going on. So it's a lot of interviewing, testing, talking with other providers, kind of doing it as a multidisciplinary team approach, looking from neurology standpoint and audiology and all those to come up with as accurate a diagnosis as we can.
So if I could follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
So Captain, it is possible that if you go down, for example, on the left side of the chart here, the TBI concussion component,
right.
if the person didn't improve over time, could that diagnosis then evolve into post-traumatic stress diagnosis?
Yeah, but it's not that black and white. I mean, they can be happening at the same time. In fact, there was a new study that was out in the New England Journal of Medicine just recently that shows mild TBI has significant impact on physical, functional, psychological problems. But when you take into account depression and PTSD, those factors kind of dissipate. I mean, so there's a lot of comorbidity and interchanging and problems in a lot of different areas. So it, you can't just say because the symptoms continue, it's something else. I mean, they could be interacting together.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Particularly for soldiers returning from Iran, Iraq, places like that, is there no tests that are given just on a regular basis upon their return after, say, a year or 16 months of service overseas to test for a variety of potential things that we know may or may not be readily at least known by just their appearance and their demeanor any longer, but it might be they may know about it or they may have some things but not be willing to come forward and mention?
There's no standardized test that an individual has to take, okay? If an individual, what is being tried, what is trying to be done in the field is if an individual is exposed to a blast, they are trying to give what's called the MACE, military assessment, concussion, I can't think of the acronym off the top of my head, but it's just a 5-minute quick and dirty, you know, see how they are cognitively impaired, or, you know, it looks at impulsivity and judgment and cognitive process type stuff. But that's really done as soon as they've been exposed, if there's somebody around that can give that. A lot of combat medics and everybody else is being trained on it. So that's really the only test. When they come back, the PDHA, the post-deployment health assessment, is really not a test. It is okay, let me sit down and mark the symptoms that I'm experiencing right now.
Oh,
to be honest with you, that is very subjective. You know, I might not want to admit that I've got a problem, and so I might not say that, yeah, this is an issue right now. So then we have what's called the PDHRA, which is a reassessment, and about 90 to 120 days out to reassess those same issues to see if there's anything that's come up from that. But tests are not just standardly given just when an individual comes back. That's what they're trying to do with this ANAM prior to and possibly coming back, but nothing right now.
But the two tests that you did mention, those are standard operating procedure, so to speak. You come back, you fill out this paperwork that
PDHA is a standard operating procedure. Yes, sir. The MACE is not. No, sir.
Okay. Could you at least guess why there would be reasons for somebody maybe not to mention some particular things? Does that have some effect on maybe their employment, so to speak, or
that's
future potential?
That's a stigma. I mean, that's a myth. It's not. I can't say it's always 100% accurate. I'm not going to say the myth doesn't have some truth to it. I mean, that's kind of where myths come from. But in their mind, you know, these soldiers, especially from the 425th, I mean, they're the ground pounders. They're going out and doing some heavy hitting things, and they don't want to they don't want to tell themselves that they have a weakness, and they might see, you know, problems as a weakness. So that might be a reason. There could be other variables that, you know, it could be from individual to individual.
Certainly, and I think because of that potential that those tests should or the standard paperwork that's filled out should probably be maybe a little more specific to at least give some kind of indicators that would call for some follow-up or something, but that's
right.
Just my opinion.
Anyway. Yes, sir.
Thank you, though.
Yes, sir.
Right. For the record, my name is Stephanie Tanner, wife of Sergeant Scott Tanner, OIF vet. In Iraq, my husband received in excess of over 30 IED explosions, upon multiple vehicle-borne IED explosions. During this last year and a half, I've seen his mental capacity decline rapidly. I urged him to receive medical treatment. Although the progress was slow, it did continue with a TBI diagnosis in May 2007. Since then, I have to assist him in driving with appointments and medication management, even though he does have an assigned case manager through the military. But his military case manager is stretched very thin. And if the military is such, being such a large entity, and they're stretched very thin, I could only imagine what the civilian side is experiencing with their very low-numbered case managers. Without the case manager that my husband receives, our life would be it would be extremely hard. We would have no access. We would have no ability to manage what he has to go through every day with all his appointments and all his medications and all his therapies. So it's not only hard on me and him, but it's hard on him as a soldier. He doesn't, as Captain Barker stated, being in such a hard unit, they don't want to admit that they're wrong, that there's something wrong. So trying to get somebody to tell him that something's wrong with him is a big is a big hard thing to do. So with that, case management is a serious and greatly needed service for TBI patients. And I'm here to stress that, because without Captain Vandermarten that he receives services from, it would be extremely, if not impossible, to function with his appointments and such. And with that, I would like to introduce...
No, there's a question. Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Stephanie, thanks for the testimony. Do you get services?
Not too many. There are options out there for me, but because I have to take so much of my time, so much of my day is dedicated to my husband, I don't get a chance to
grow. And just a follow-up, if you may, Madam Chair. I mean, the services you get, are they provided by the military, or are you seeking them off base?
No, they're provided by the military.
By the military. Yes. Okay. Thanks for your testimony.
Yes. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. Was your husband diagnosed with TBI prior to returning from overseas, or was it after?
No, his Iraq deployment was from 2000 to 2005, 2004 to 2005, and at that time the military didn't recognize TBI as a wide thing. So he went on living with his TBI for a year and a half before anybody recognized it, and that's really what is hindering his progress now, because if TBI patients don't get help and management services within the first year, it's shown that your progress that you can make is severely hindered by that, which is what we're facing right now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there others to speak?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm Dr. Russell S. Cherry. I work at Providence Hospital. And I'm going to reiterate in some different forms some of the stories that we've been hearing. Just to give you some idea, again, thank you, a common theme of traumatic brain injury being the hidden epidemic. It's the most common cause of injury for individuals 15 to 40. It's particularly relevant in Alaska because our rates statewide are 7 times the national average. If you go out into the bush, the rate of traumatic brain injury is approximately 14 times the national average. I worked at Alaska Native Medical Center for 3 years, and while I was working there, every week I would see approximately 4 to 5 individuals, typically between 15 to 40 years, who were injured because of reliance on ATVs and snow machine for transportation, because of a culture that doesn't wear helmets, and often alcohol is a factor in about half of all of the brain injuries. At Providence Hospital, I see every single day from meetings with the ER manager, there's approximately 2 mild traumatic brain injuries every day where people are injured, their other physical symptoms are treated, and they're essentially discharged to the street with no further follow-up. I'll often see those people again in my outpatient practice, usually 6 to 9 months later, once they've been fired from their work, they're having problems with their spouse, or they're having, you know, some other sort of major life circumstance, at which point the traumatic brain injury will be identified and that will prompt the referral. But a lot of those problems, if you think about it, are avoidable were there a better system of identification on the front end. Also with the veterans, I've seen the very beginning of this wave that's coming back. The veterans just returned, approximately 4,000 in the last 2 weeks. I've seen approximately 10 different veterans. I anticipate in the next several months, with time, as people have problems at work, as people have problems in spousal relationships, I think we're going to see much higher numbers. And I kind of look at it as sort of a tsunami that's out there that's approaching. When you're talking about brain injury, I think one thing to look at is it's not just a cognitive injury. There's also very commonly psychiatric issues that accompany it. Across the board, anyone with a traumatic brain injury, approximately 70% of people have clinical depression, where they're not able to get out of bed, they're not motivated to do hygiene, they can't do just basic tasks. And that's on top of the injury. In addition to depression, with the veteran populations, what I see as a rule is post-traumatic stress disorder. And if you think about it, it makes sense. If you're involved in an IED blast where you're blown out of the vehicle, and let's say your friends and coworkers usually have been killed, that's something that's a very traumatic experience. And just in my recent experiences working with the vets, assessing them, or the active duty soldiers, having some trauma issues is the norm. Working in other states in California, Missouri, Minnesota, I guess I'm used to having some sort of system in place. I relocated to Alaska 5 years ago. I love it here. But from a provider standpoint, it's very frustrating because normal options that I have simply don't exist, where we simply don't have brain injury case managers. We don't have any sort of housing program for people with severe traumatic brain injuries. Just things that are considered just a normal part of the system don't exist. And if you think about that, it's particularly ironic given that we lead the nation in brain injury and we have, you know, disproportionately high rates. Looking here, if you look at base rates of injury, comparing brain injury to, let's say, Alzheimer's disease or HIV or any other sort of medical issue, it's interesting to me that we have some great programs in the state, for example, for Alzheimer's, where the Alzheimer's Resource Association, they have case managers, they have caregiver support groups, they have educational materials, they have all of these resources, and that's for something that occurs at a significantly lower rate than brain injury. And it's just curious to me, there's a number of medical issues that for whatever reason seem to get much more attention and services than the issue that occurs most frequently in the population, at least for younger people. Some of the effects of this lack of system, this lack of infrastructure, are we have poor information sharing between providers, where often I will see patients and I will be completely unaware of the fact that they've been seen by a psychiatrist, that they've had an MRI, that they've been seen by a neurologist, because there's no information sharing. And the downside of that is that it makes my job more difficult to diagnose brain injury, because I don't have this supporting information. Often what I see is in our system, what we have at present, the onus of responsibility is on the brain injured patient or their caregiver to navigate this medical system. And you know, by definition, these people have problems with attention, memory, and multiple step tasks. And so what typically happens is, you know, providers can make referrals to each other, and this patient simply is not able to follow through. They're not able to remember the appointment. Maybe they can't drive to get to the appointment. They can't complete the paperwork for the appointment. And so it's very difficult without support, and that support is typically case management. Simply having a case manager or a case coordinator can help, you know, sort of fill in the gaps between providers, make sure that people get to appointments, help them complete the requisite paperwork for the appointment, and sometimes they present to the appointment with the patient. One of my worst case scenarios that unfortunately is quite frequent is I will see a brain injured patient in my office with no caregiver, no spouse, no other information, and it's just me interviewing this person who has serious memory or attentional problems and is not a very good historian, meaning they can't really, they don't have good insight, and they can't really tell me their pertinent issues. For children in the state of Alaska who have moderate to severe traumatic brain injury, and to go to an earlier question, for moderate or severe brain injury, typically you can see that on an MRI scan, and if someone is seen by a neurologist, they will also evidence some signs that are clear indicators of moderate to severe brain injury. With the kids in the state of Alaska who have moderate to severe brain injuries, at present we're shipping them out of state, typically to Texas or Wisconsin, and one of the problems with that is that in the midst of dealing with recovery from brain injury, they're also completely cut off from their support system. So as you would imagine, that just worsens issues. In general, with brain injury, what I describe it as sort of a ripple effect. If you throw a rock into the water, it's concentric circles, where first you have the victim affected, then you have the spouse affected, then you have their children affected. And often if they, you know, wherever they're working, their workplace is affected. And so it just goes on and on. Other things that I often see with brain injury are accompanying substance abuse disorders. Because they're depressed, because they're unemployed, often they lose their employment, they get further depressed and they start abusing alcohol more heavily, or sometimes other drugs. Another thing that I see quite frequently with brain injury are people getting additional injuries. Because of their impaired judgment, they're going out and doing things that are rendering them susceptible to further injury. And another thing that I see are people with brain injuries being predated upon by others, where people are taking advantage of them financially. And if we look at, you know, I'm describing a lot of problems at length, the cure is relatively easy. It's relatively simple. It's not Star Wars missile defense. It's pretty much looking at some sort of case management or case coordination, and that's just hiring a few people, bachelor's level, usually newly minted graduates, to, you know, ensure that the patient isn't falling through the gaps, to help them complete paperwork, to help, you know, present to them with interviews, to make sure that they're getting to the various providers. Other things that we can do in the state that would be exceedingly helpful is have some sort of standard packet of information that could be handed out at the ER rooms or other locations, where it would basically be a guide. So you're brain injured in Alaska, here's a step-by-step what to do in a sequential order. That would help simplify things greatly. Also, having that information on a website would be very important. Another thing, I describe a phenomenon of these providers working in isolation, where no one's aware of what the other provider is doing, and I think it would be helpful to create a network of identified providers with a common release, so then, you know, without a whole lot of problem, I can get records from that neurologist, from that MRI, so then we can better share information, which is always to the advantage of the patient. Other things that would be helpful are just doing a better job of screening for brain injury in certain locations, like the emergency room, like physical therapy or rehabilitation clinics, because what I see is often in the ER, people will be treated for multiple broken limbs, they'll have lacerations to the head, but no one seems to be thinking about what happened to the brain in the midst of all of these injuries. Other things that would be helpful are having a vocational rehabilitation, like division vocational rehabilitation or other rehabilitation specialists, having them trained specifically in brain injury, because people with brain injury have a different set of circumstances than other populations, where they can have some cognitive problems and they can have some emotional or impulse control problems. And because of their unique needs, they often do best working with some rehab specialist who's trained in TBI. Other things are looking at an assisted living facility. We have a number of them that are already in existence, but looking at providing their staff members some specific training to brain injury. What I see in our current sort of system is people with severe brain injury will be transferred to an assisted living center, and they don't really know anything about traumatic brain injury, and the patient will evidence some sort of typical brain injury behavior, and the staff will have a response that is inappropriate, and often the individual gets kicked out of the assisted living centers and is homeless. And this is something, unfortunately, that I've seen repeatedly. So simply finding one already existing ASL and providing their staff some training on how to better deal with and manage brain injury, that would be invaluable. I think another thing which has kind of been alluded to before is just creating some partnerships. The military, they have a great program right now. I'm impressed by it. I've worked at the VA before, where they have a multidisciplinary clinic to help address the soldiers' needs. My concern is, in a few months, some of their neuropsychologists and some of their other personnel are going to be leaving. And my biggest concern is that I think a lot of those people who are brain injured, a lot of their issues are going to come to the surface after this team is gone. And so what we have to look at is creating some sort of partnership between the military, between, let's say, Providence or any other major player hospitals in the community, and, you know, making sure everyone's on the same page. For the bush, for people out in the bush, like I said, brain injury is a far more common event out in the bush, and one thing that we could simply do is look at telemedicine, where psychiatrists can work with them via teleconferencing, and that's something that would be an easy solution for some of the transportation issues. And one thing that I'd really like to see is some liaisons with Anchorage School District and with the mental health and wellness courts, where people with traumatic brain injury are being better identified, so you know, to these various systems, so they can better cope with those issues. And so in sum, you know, a bottom line is that we, I think, need to do a better job of raising awareness and educate people about the prevalence of brain injury and the fact that it's the most common injury in the state of Alaska. And I think with a few relatively simple interventions, I think we can make a huge difference in the quality of life of the patients, of their family members, of their kids, and of the community at large. Thank you.
You put a lot on the plate, on our plates there.
Yes. I talk fast. I'm sorry.
Very good. That's quite all right. I'm sure there's comments and questions to be asked, but before we pass it along to somebody else, I want to know if there is an existence, any kind of support groups that you know about, or anybody that's working in that area, you know if there's a support group out there?
Support group for?
Yeah, for brain injuries.
Okay, sure.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Access Alaska has head injury support groups around the state, and they do a phenomenal job, and they have opened up their support group to military as well. And mm-hmm. those in the civilian sector are really trying to reach out, knowing that a TBI survivor talking to another TBI survivor, it does a lot for their well-being and for their future and for their confidence in themselves. And here in Juneau, the Department of Labor, Margie Thompson, she heads the head injury support group. And it's one of the most active support groups in the entire state.
She has the group?
She facilitates. And also Jeff Irwin with SAIL. I believe it's Southeast Assisted Independent Living. Yes.
And so that's a volunteer and not her job, right?
It's a component of her job.
Oh, it's a component of the job?
I believe.
Okay. And that's the state agency you're referring to?
Yes, but she does it. I'm not sure about if it's required of her. I do know it happens after hours, and I do know that a lot of these agencies are just stepping up and developing that as part of their programming.
Okay, thank you.
Did that answer a little?
Well, that helps a little bit. I suppose that okay. It would be good for us if you had a list of things of what you would like to see happen so that we'll... just have right. this meeting with you now. You know, maybe there's a few dollars. I don't know what's in the budget for you or if there is anything in the budget for you. Well, but there are other things that need to be worked on between now and another year. We just can't wait till next March and say, okay, we're going to take this in consideration. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what we need to do to provide some help or some assistance with your guidance and some of the things that you tell us. Mm-hmm. We might be able to help in some of the areas that was identified by the doctor.
Yes. To speak to that a little bit more, we really can and have been studying other states. And Virginia, which you see in your packet, has done a phenomenal job of funding. And right now they have two types of funding. They have general fund funding, and they also have a traumatic brain injury waiver, so Medicaid funding. Mm-hmm. And those are two components that really would assist the state of Alaska. And with their general fund, what they've chosen, or what their report shows, is that case management and clubhouse programs have the most bang for their buck. And there's a lot more information around those issues. And we do have some exact budget requests and some program requests that we'd like to see in this year's budget, certainly around case management. And what is in Governor Palin's budget is a small line item of $100,000. It's brain injury training for providers. And so that is included in Governor Palin's budget. And how the Brain Injury Network works budget recommendations is we advocate to the four statutory boards, the Commission on Aging, Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the Governor's Council, and the Mental Health Board. And we ask them, you know, will you make recommendations on behalf of brain injury? And they make recommendations to the Mental Health Trust Authority. And so when we come to them, you know, they have their issues as well. But they do provide very small increments, $25,000 here or $50,000 there, $100,000 there. And they take those to the trust. And this year, the trust approved four of those recommendations. So in the trust budget, you will see $25,000, a very small increment, to enhance what they already fund for information and referral for brain injury. There is the training aspect was $175,000, but it was reduced in the governor's budget. And then they have their housing focus area. Are you familiar with the housing focus area with the trust? Well, within their housing focus area, they had a GFMH budget recommendation of $200,000 for brain injury services development to start that momentum going within the department. And that was not included in Governor Palin's budget either. So there are trust authority budget recommendations mm-hmm. that we would like to see moved into the legislative budget. And you know, that long-term support, that $200,000 would really go towards that case management component for this year, so that we can start getting these people organized and getting them connected to what we do have in the state. And as you could see, we have phenomenal people in the state who really know what they're doing, and they're doing the best that they can to develop multidisciplinary teams that they need on the rehab side. But for as a state to plan for this, as you see in the promising practices for state systems document I gave you, there really are continuum of care models for brain injury and where the funding should come from and how they work on the lifetime of the person with the brain injury. The rehab component is 2 years max. After that, the person is living with their disability from there. And there are many Alaskans who will not work, and they need places to go during the day to be socially appropriate and to be productive and to have some confidence in their life. And that's how, where a clubhouse comes in. And then also, there are those folks who just don't function in society that well. We met a young man. We are in Texas in November. We visited 5 rehab facilities. And we went to a long-term living home. It's called Live Oak. It's outside of San Marcos. And we showed up. We toured the facility. It's basically just a ranch style. There's houses all over, and people with cognitive disabilities live there. The first man we met has lived in that facility for 20 years. And the next guy we met hopped out of the van. He started walking off to his house. And then the owner of the facility yelled, "Hey, Corey, you want to come meet some fellow Alaskans?" And we're like, "Oh, we have an Alaskan here. We'd love to meet him too." So we met Corey, and Corey at age 10 had an ATV accident in Kotzebue. He was sent to Texas because he had a severe brain injury. And Corey is 26 years old now, and he's very happy living in Texas. He has his Texas family now. But the truth is about Corey is when people with brain injuries, they function at a level that's appropriate when they have the right supports and they're living in the right environment. If they don't have that support in the correct environment, they drop, and they're the ones who are being socially inappropriate. They're the ones causing the mishap in society. And a lot of people with these behavioral discontrol issues, if they live in these environments where they are supported in the right structure, they live at this great equilibrium where they can improve a little bit, but they're pretty stagnant. But the real issue is the fact that these people without that support would be in our society, and they would definitely be having a hard time themselves and safety of others as well.
Very good. I would like, I know you did tell us a whole lot and that it is recorded, but I would like for you to give in writing to me some of the things that you would like to see in the budget, or that's already in the budget, or areas that need to be discussed with other people outside in the community other than just the state agencies and money that's coming from there. Because there might be lots of things that can be done. The clubhouse that you talked about, I was just at a meeting not too long ago that was dealing with some brain injury, and they were telling us about the clubhouses. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, clubhouse? You know, you're thinking of something elite, but when they explain what it really was and mm-hmm. what they do, mm-hmm. Very nice concept. Mm-hmm. And you would think that we would have something like that if you say 7-11 times above the national average mm-hmm. with injuries. In that light, there's lots of work to be done. I appreciate you coming before us.
Thank you.
And I hope we will continue to touch bases with each other. Yes, Senator Elton?
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I know we don't have an awful lot of time, so maybe it would be easier to get back in touch. But Doctor, I'm curious, as I mean, it seems to me that if something like this happened in my family, mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing that we would want to know is, does our insurance cover it? Mm-hmm. And that leads us into, you know, kind of a bigger discussion, mental health parity. How does the insurance industry look at this? Is this a mental health issue? Is this a physical? Is this a physical medical kind of a thing? How do they pay for it,
and
or do they?
That's an excellent question. For neuropsychological evaluations, those are billed under medical codes, neurological codes. So it's not, so mental health parity isn't even an issue.
Okay.
Because it's considered a medical issue, a medical evaluation. Where it can get a little sticky is later on in treatment. If someone is diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury and they're having, let's say, clinically significant depression or anxiety, in the treatment phase, often they have to see a mental health provider, a prescriber for that treatment. Sometimes that their insurance company can cause them some problems with that, but just to back out from your question a little bit more is, imagine trying to navigate that insurance company system with a brain injury. And that's one of the most common things that I'll see is people are, they just, you know, for me, when I've had to deal with my insurance company, I struggle with that. And I can't imagine having a brain injury and being able to follow through and figure out things like that. So.
And I'm looking around the audience, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
And if I saw somebody mm-hmm. from the insurance industry here, I might not say what I'm going to say, but you might want to turn the TV camera off.
They're going to hear about it anyway.
But it seems to me that there would be some reluctance by the industry to pay for case management that would then, in the end, cost them money.
Well, and that's an interesting point because it would cost them money at the onset, and yet statistically, if you look at some of the research, an argument can easily be made. If you get people the right services in the acute phase of recovery from brain injury, their productivity and their ability to regain function is going to be significantly higher. And
right.
I think that was described earlier by Mrs. Tanner, where her husband didn't receive services in the acute phase of injury, which is typically within the first 2 years. And what happens is their recovery curve is their gains are significantly limited. Because it's just within the 2 year period after the injury where things are reconnecting, and that's where if you're getting any sort of intervention at that time, it has its greatest effect. You can have recovery further on down the road. It's just it's a lot less. It's your ability to recover is more diminished.
Yes. Yes, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Elton. I just wanted on that point to highlight with our family's experience how critical that was, and it ultimately mm-hmm. did save, if you want to look at it, the state and certainly an insurance provider money. Mm-hmm. We were very lucky because my dad was in the public health service, so mm-hmm. so we had insurance that covered USAA on the car that went ahead and covered Jason through 2 full years of treatment, and we call him our $1 million kid. Because he truly is, and at the point where he had started to go, you know, learning the bathroom and tying his shoes again, a regular insurance company would have run out. And the thought that I had at that moment in time as a young woman was, you know, even before policymaking, was that doesn't make any sense at all, because the cost to all of us, the cost to the system is going to be so high if you send this young man out into the world, unable to use the bathroom, unable to care for himself, unable to tie his shoes and all those sorts of things, to hold down more or less, to hold down any type of meaningful work, and then all of the social problems that could stem out of that. So I just wanted to share an experience where that did work and where it did save money. And then to Senator Davis's questions, I look forward to working with her. We work on a lot of issues, but we have, you know, through the years, you know, been trying to look at some of the things that we can do here in the state, and I look forward to working with you and this committee to try and see what we can build, because I think at the end of the day, it not only will it benefit the families and the survivors of traumatic brain injury, but I think there is a cost element to it.
Yes.
As well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. We certainly thank you for coming forward, and we've run out of time. It's 3:05, and we will have to adjourn the meeting. The dialogue can continue at a later time. I'll give Senator Thomas a chance to give his last words if he wanted to say something.
Oh, you always think I got something to say. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I do. You know, it seems like this is not an unusual situation. In so many of the things that come before this committee, we deal with the problem, not the solution. And I don't know when we'll get around to dealing with the solutions more directly. But anyhow, thank you for your testimony and possibly through your society and the hospitals or whatever, you could put forth some kind of, you know, concepts that you see should be incorporated into existing statute. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
And Senator Calgary, are you still there?
Still here.
We're glad that you were with us today, and we're getting ready to adjourn. You have any final words?
No comments. It was an interesting meeting.
All right. Okay, at this time, we adjourn.